From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. We address two topics on this edition of the program, strains in U.S.-China relations following a visit to Taiwan by the top U.S. lawmaker in the lower chamber of Congress, and the state of play in Russia's war on Ukraine. First, China's retaliatory moves against Taiwan and the United States after Speaker of the House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi led a congressional delegation to Taiwan in early August. Speaker Pelosi said that the goal of the visit was to salute a thriving democracy, even as the U.S. adheres to the One China policy, which acknowledges Beijing's position that Taiwan is a part of China. To help us understand why Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan infuriated Beijing, which took military, economic, and diplomatic retaliatory measures against the island, we turn to Bonnie Glaser, director of the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a prominent think tank based in Washington, a frequent guest on our sister program, Encounter. Bonnie Glaser will also explain why the timing, if not the purpose of the visit, may have been ill-advised. Bonnie Glaser joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Bonnie Glaser, let's go right to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, the aftermath. Basically, I wanted to get your reaction to the visit, particularly while the United States is embroiled in combating Russian aggression in Ukraine. Some analysts have criticized Speaker Pelosi's visit, the timing, not so much the purpose and the right that she has to make that visit. What is your take?
Well, my take from the beginning, even before Speaker Pelosi left the United States for her Asia tour, was that this visit to Taiwan was ill-timed. The speaker does have a right to go. We have co-equal branches of government in the United States and separation of powers. The president cannot tell Speaker Pelosi not to go. But I felt that this was a very sensitive time. China's confidence in the U.S. One China policy is very low. The relationship really has deteriorated in recent months. And we had the PLA founding anniversary, the leaders meeting at Beidaihe, probably now. And then, of course, coming up this fall is the 20th Party Congress, when Xi Jinping will likely get a third term in power. And so I think for all these reasons, the Chinese were likely to react quite strongly. And I think that if Speaker Pelosi had gone later this year, perhaps if the U.S.-China relationship could have stabilized a bit, if the United States could have shored up China's confidence in our One China policy, that maybe China's reaction would not have been quite as strong as it was.
To follow up on that, particularly as it relates to U.S. politics, do you think in retrospect that Speaker Pelosi might have reconsidered had she known the consequences? We're seeing extraordinary military drills against Taiwan. China has also broken off talks with the United States over climate, and they have also halted theater-level contacts between military commanders. I guess the question then is, does the good her visit may have done outweigh these negative consequences, or is it the reverse, perhaps?
So I think that my assessment is probably different than Nancy Pelosi's. I think she probably believes that China has outed itself as a bully. It has conducted all these intimidating exercises against Taiwan, taken economic coercion measures against Taiwan, and also, as you say, cut off dialogues with the United States, you know, all because of her visit to Taiwan. And her view is, oh, so many members of Congress have been there before, so why should China overreact to hers? Yeah, my view is that ultimately what matters when the United States does something for Taiwan or with Taiwan, the criteria as to whether or not we should actually take an action should be, will it help Taiwan? Will it strengthen Taiwan's security? Or will it detract from that security? And my view from the beginning was that this visit was likely to imperil Taiwan's security. And I think that is what we have seen. We have also given China an opportunity not only to conduct all of these exercises and improve its military capabilities and show that it can impose a blockade, but we have given China the opportunity to change the status quo in its favor in the Taiwan Strait. And I think that's what we're going to see going forward.
Well, you mentioned Taiwan. Of course, The government put on a very positive face. They welcomed Nancy Pelosi. But I wonder, do you think they may share, that is, members of the government share your view to some extent, given the repercussions of the visit?
Well, there may be some different views within the U.S. government. There may be some people who think that countries will see China for the bully that it is. Maybe because the missiles landed in Japan's exclusive economic zone, the Japanese will be even more motivated to work with the United States to strengthen deterrence, to prepare for possible contingencies involving Taiwan. So there may be some people who see upsides from this. But I think that there are also people in the U.S. government who believe that the situation would have been more stable if the visit had not taken place now.
And members of the Biden administration seem to be engaged in what appears to be some type of damage control, notwithstanding the vociferous statements, particularly from Secretary of State Antony Blinken, saying that Beijing has used Pelosi's visit as a pretext to do what it has always been doing, engaging in these aggressive actions vis-a-vis Taiwan. But nonetheless, one has to wonder if they would have preferred perhaps a different time, as you have suggested, for the Pelosi visit. And what about Taiwan? What has been their reaction? As I was saying earlier, they certainly would welcome a visit by such a high-level official in the United States, a lawmaker. But are they expressing some concern now about the timing of her visit, given the actions that China has been taking militarily and diplomatically and in relation to trade against Taiwan?
We have heard nothing from Taiwan's government to suggest that they regret that this visit took place. Just the opposite. I think senior leaders, officials in Taiwan, including their representative here in Washington, D.C., have said they welcome friends. When friends come from afar, you treat them well. And Taiwan doesn't have a lot of friends, and it's to some extent isolated by China. And so when they get visits from parliaments, whether it's visits from parliaments from the United States or Europe or elsewhere, they want to welcome people with open arms who support Taiwan and its security and its prosperity. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some people who are a little worried about maybe the negative impact on Taiwan's security in the short term. I think a lot of people will say this was a win for Taiwan. Over time, I think that there will be negative impacts on Taiwan's security. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope that the balance will still be on the positive side over time, but I'm just not so sure.
Bonnie Glazer, let's go back to the very context in which this visit took place, that is the visit of Nancy Pelosi, but also Beijing's aggressive posture vis-a-vis Taiwan. We have the backdrop, of course, of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Do you think Beijing is taking any cues from Moscow with regard to how it is dealing with Taiwan? Before Speaker Pelosi's visit, have you observed that Beijing has been acting aggressively, not just pronouncing aggressive rhetoric, but actually dealing more aggressively with Taiwan? And some analysts are saying that they're concerned whether the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, might try to seek reunification by military force.
Well, my view is that China would prefer to not unify Taiwan through force. I think they would rather use peaceful means. If that doesn't work, they're trying coercive means, and these will continue. I think force remains on the table. It is a possibility. If Taiwan were to declare independence, if the United States supports an independent Taiwan, China will use force, whether or not it believes it is ready. If the party instructs the military to attack Taiwan, I believe they will do so. But I don't think that that is the Communist Party or Xi Jinping's first choice. He talks quite a bit about how he and the party will strive with the utmost sincerity to achieve peaceful reunification. I actually think that that is something he would like to achieve. And China has a big toolkit to use against Taiwan. Sometimes it uses positive inducements. Increasingly, it uses economic and diplomatic and military coercion. And I think that they will increasingly use legal warfare. They are looking to Hong Kong to actually find some lessons that they can draw for approaches to how they could govern Taiwan. Chinese experts are studying what a Taiwan version of one country, two systems would look like, for example. So they're planning and thinking about ruling Taiwan after peaceful unification, but they haven't ruled out military means. And as far as your question goes on Ukraine, I tend to think that Xi Jinping has his own perspective on Taiwan and his own logic that really isn't connected to Ukraine. I think China is different from Russia, and I think Taiwan is quite different from Ukraine. So I really don't think that the Chinese are drawing too many direct lessons from that experience. Sure, they will study the military operations that Russia is implementing, and they will study the sanctions that the international community is imposing on Russia and try and insulate China's economy from such sanctions. But at the end of the day, their approach to Taiwan, whether or not they decide to use force, I think is just very separate from Ukraine.
Here's a different question with regard to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, with regard to the United States. Do you think Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has in any way jeopardized talks between the United States and China vis-a-vis Russia's invasion of Ukraine, whereby the United States would like to tell China, look, don't go overtly supporting Russia in its aggression against Ukraine? Because, you know, they do have, that is, Moscow and Beijing seem to have some sort of a geostrategic alliance against the West.
Well, I wouldn't call it an alliance, and I don't think that Washington cares how outspoken China is in support of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What it cares about is whether or not the Chinese government provides material support to Russia's economy or to the war effort in Ukraine. And President Biden has made perfectly clear that if China does so, that there will be consequences. So even if our two leaders are not having a phone call this week or next week or even very soon, China's gotten that message. Xi Jinping understands that very clearly. I think the more concerning issue is that the suspension of U.S.-China dialogues has really prevented near-term opportunities to talk about risk reduction, crisis communication measures. For example, the planned meeting between the theater commanders, the meeting of the military maritime consultative arrangement, which was scheduled for later this year, and the defense policy consultation talks that were also planned for later this year. So those are off. That doesn't mean that they won't occur next year or maybe even sooner. When the Chinese decide it's in their interests and they're ready to reengage, I think that all of those will be resumed.
And Bonnie, as we close, China did extend its provocative military exercises, as you know, in the waters and air surrounding Taiwan beyond the day that the drills had been scheduled to end. To what extent are you worried that this isn't blowing over, so to speak? That is, China's anger over Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. To what extent are you a bit worried that this could continue over a longer period of time? Or do you think that it will blow over to some extent? Or are we at a different juncture now? Has this, in a sense, permanently escalated tensions between the United States and China and China and Taiwan?
Well, as I noted earlier, I do think that China is going to try to use this opportunity to change the status quo further in its favor. It will try to create a new normal around Taiwan. It will operate more frequently north of the median line, the center line, which, of course, China says it doesn't recognize in the Taiwan Strait. It may conduct more frequent military exercises that look like what we have seen over the last week with missile firings over Taiwan and landing areas that are very, very close to Taiwan and even overlap with neighboring exclusive economic zones, such as in the Philippines or Japan. So I think this is exactly what China is trying to do. And we even heard China's foreign ministry spokesman say that China will continuously put pressure on the United States and Taiwan going forward. So this is yet another indication of intention to try to create this new normal in which the prevailing situation around Taiwan is less favorable to Taiwan, less favorable to the United States, and more favorable to Beijing.
Do you have any suggestions or recommendations for the U.S. government going forward with regard to calming relations and getting things back to normal, so to speak, getting the dialogue back on climate and trying to restore the status quo ante, how would you advise the government?
Well, I don't think that the United States should be overeager to reestablish dialogues with China, because that simply puts more leverage in China's hands. But I do think that for our own interests, we should be trying to clarify what our one China policy is and what it isn't. We have to restore some credibility to our one China policy, because it has been very confusing. The United States has said things and taken actions that seem to be at odds with our one China policy. For example, early in the Biden administration, there was a sitting ambassador from the United States to Palau who visited Taiwan. That was unprecedented. I'm not myself convinced that that's consistent with a one China policy. And then we had a month or so ago, the State Department take down its webpage and remove the phrase, the United States does not support Taiwan independence, and put that back up. And then, of course, a few weeks later, it was basically restored to what it had been before. And we've also heard President Biden say that the United States has a commitment to defend Taiwan. Well, actually, he has the prerogative as president to come to Taiwan's defense and to give that order. But we do not legally have such a commitment under the Taiwan Relations Act. So I think there's been a bit of confusion in U.S. policy. I think we have to be more disciplined, more consistent, more clear about what our one China policy means. And then perhaps China may or may not, we'll have to see, but they may or may not overreact or react so strongly to what they say is a hollowing out of our one China policy or salami slicing our one China policy. So I think it's in the interests of the United States to get control of this narrative a bit better. And the American public should know what our one China policy actually is.
Bonnie Glaser is director of the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Bonnie Glaser, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. We've been speaking with Bonnie Glaser, director of the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, about China's provocative military drills aimed at Taiwan in the wake of U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to the island. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel, or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Peter Clever Kingson from Owerri, the capital of Imo State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, from tensions in the Taiwan Strait to Russia's unlawful invasion of Ukraine, in this segment, we will talk with Anna Borshevskaya, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a prominent think tank here in Washington. She's the author of the book, Putin's War in Syria, Russian Foreign Policy and the Price of America's Absence. We spoke with Anna in early March, soon after the invasion on February 24, and we are delighted to welcome her back to Press Conference USA via Microsoft Teams. Anna Borshevskaya, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Carol.
Anna, the last time you were here was in early March, and the Russian army had fired from all sides upon the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. That's the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, based, of course, in Ukraine, causing great panic. Well, 5 months later, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is again in the news. The Russians are in nominal control using Ukrainian operators, but now Russia is exploiting its position in the power plant that it sees to target a nearby town with rocket attacks. The IAEA has urged both sides to exercise restraint, warning of a risk of nuclear disaster. Why is Russia playing with fire, so to speak, Anna?
The short answer, I suppose, is that Russia is playing with fire, for one thing, because it can, more specifically because Russia is determined to destroy Ukrainian sovereignty, to destroy the idea of Ukraine as a nation, as an idea. I suspect that the dreams of government change in Kiev are probably still fairly prominent in the ruling elite thinking. And the fact of the matter is, this is how Russia does warfare. It is brutal. and they often destroy territory to take it. They have this position right now. As you said, they've taken this power plant earlier, and they exploit any opportunity that they have.
Moving along, let's take a look at another, actually a setback for Russia. What is your assessment of the strike on Russia's Sakhy Air Base in southwestern Crimea, which suffered extensive fire damage, according to Reuters, with burned out husks of at least 8 destroyed warplanes? How much of a setback, in your view, is this for Russia's war strategy in Ukraine? Because it was trying to pivot from the Donbas in the east to attack southern Ukraine.
Well, it's a little bit too soon to tell. It's certainly significant, and that's why you see the Russian side downplaying its importance. The fact of the matter is, this is one tactical piece still of a bigger picture that is still unfolding. And from a big picture perspective, what we're now looking at is the Ukrainian counteroffensive in the south, as well as Russian gains in the Donbas region. They're fairly small if you kind of watch this from a day-to-day tactical movement perspective, but it's still happening. And really the key question is, first and foremost, that the coming weeks are going to be very important in terms of what turn the war might take. The fact of the matter is, Ukrainians, and they admit this themselves, when they train militarily, they train for defensive operations, not for offensive operations. And if Ukrainians are able to capture Kherson, if they're able to actually have a successful counteroffensive in the strategic south — the south is very important because it has to do with access to the Black Sea, with strategic waterways, with Russia's trying to carve out a land corridor from Russia to Crimea. So if the Ukrainians are in fact successful at a critical time when cold weather is coming, by approximately mid-September or so, it might put the Ukrainians in a better negotiating position in the future. But at this point, again, we're seeing smaller tactical pieces. The bigger picture will likely show itself in the weeks, if not months, ahead. Military experts say that any war looks very different with the benefit of hindsight when you take a step back rather than when you look at it from a day-to-day operation.
That's certainly true. But one more question on this Sakhy Air Base and the strategy of Ukraine. What does this strike tell you about Ukraine's tactics and strategy to defend its sovereign territory from further Russian aggression and to recover parts of the east that Russia is controlling, and now even Crimea, which Moscow illegally annexed in 2014? President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that the liberation of Russian-occupied Crimea is now an official war aim.
First, what this says is that Ukrainians remain determined, that their morale remains high, and they are able to make tactical gains. So again, from a tactical perspective, this is important. And again, this is why the Russians are downplaying what happens. But again, it's a smaller piece in the bigger picture. In the bigger picture, really, the weeks ahead are going to be especially important for all the reasons that I've mentioned. Kherson region and the Zaporizhia regions are important because Russian forces had taken them early on in the invasion. And the location is what matters strategically. And together with southern Donetsk, especially, they form a land bridge connecting Russia to Crimea. And so if the Ukrainians are able to stop Russia from cutting Ukraine off from vital access to the Sea of Azov and to the Black Sea, what the Ukrainians are also trying to do here, what they've been successful tactically in recent weeks, is blowing up strategic bridges, again, to preventing Russians from moving in. The indicators on the ground were that the Russians were planning another false referendum in Kherson, very much like what they had done in Crimea. The date of September 11th was floated around, and now it seems like there's no specific date. So again, tactically, that's important. The ability to conduct these tactical operations does show certain strength on the Ukrainian parts. It's a smaller piece in a bigger picture.
Further to that, Anna Borshevskaya, how would you assess overall Ukraine's strategy and the political will of the leadership and the resilience of the Ukrainian people, notwithstanding Russia's disinformation campaign against them? What do you think their bottom line is? What, in your view, is Kyiv seeking as a goal?
You're asking two very important questions here, and one specifically is about the Ukrainian strategy. To the best of our knowledge that we can understand the Ukrainian strategy, it does go back to the point that I made earlier, and that is that on the one hand, there's no lack of willpower, no lack of determination. If anything, Russian atrocities like in Bucha that we've seen in other places, the tortures of Ukrainians, since that we've seen the indiscriminate bombings. All of these actions, if anything, have strengthened the resolve of the Ukrainians. And the fact of the matter is, analytically, those of us who know Ukraine, I think, are not surprised, because Ukrainians have always resisted control. Ukraine is the one country in the post-Soviet space that has escaped Putin's grip and has gone as far as it has in terms of joining the West. And that is one of the key reasons why he's punishing Ukraine with this war. Having said that, again, on the flip side, going back to my point earlier, if there is a Ukrainian strategy, it is mostly defensive. And they also remain reliant on outside help, chiefly on weapons coming from the United States. Europe, by some accounts of military analysts, is almost tapped out when it comes to weaponry. A lot of European stockpiles will take years to replenish. So really, it's mostly on the United States to continue providing Ukraine with weaponry. It is mostly on the West to keep its unity, especially in the coming months ahead, again, when the weather is going to get cold, when Russia is already threatened to cut off gas to Europe. So on the one hand, there's no shortage of resolve. And in fact, the Russian side was probably surprised early in the war, in the very early weeks of the war, to the extent that the Ukrainians were able to resist. But on the flip side, again, Ukraine remains dependent on Western assistance, and they keep asking for more weapons, and they will need more weapons. We're often too slow in providing them the weapons that they need. We often don't provide enough. And so the course of this war, certainly its end remains uncertain. But again, one way or the other, they're looking at long-term protracted warfare. And Russian aims for their part to destroy Ukrainian sovereignty in the long term have not changed. Even if they take a tactical pause for months. The Ukrainian side, most recently, from what we heard, it seems, wants to go back to the pre-February 2014 borders. How likely that is, to some extent, again, will depend on the Ukrainian negotiating position. And that's why what will happen in Kherson might potentially, as analysts are suggesting, shift the dynamic of the war.
Anna Borshevskaya, you just said that Russia still maintains its goal of conquering Ukraine. But it seems that given their many tactical defeats, notwithstanding their bullying and ability to bomb indiscriminately, it seems that their resolve, at least compared to that of Ukraine, has to have diminished somewhat. Do you think that Vladimir Putin has recalculated in the face of fierce Ukrainian resistance and a unified West and NATO that continue to provide Ukrainians with weapons, notwithstanding not as fast as they would like, humanitarian and economic assistance, as well as sanctions against Moscow?
Unfortunately, no. No, I don't think that at all. Also, in terms of correlation of forces, military analysts, when they talk about Russia, they talk about correlation of forces. When you take a look at correlation of forces, Russia still has plenty of artillery, plenty of ammunition, and despite the heavy losses that you've mentioned, still enough manpower. But ultimately, the bigger issue is that when it comes to the Kremlin's calculus, no, if you look at their statements, they remain committed to the long haul, and they are banking on Western disunity eventually. Again, the time calculus here is in much longer term, not in weeks. If you look at Putin's statements in previous months, for example, he brought up the 21 years Northern War, the war that Peter the Great fought with Sweden, a war that he reminded everybody when he spoke domestically, but it was a message both for domestic and foreign audiences, a war that began with Russian setbacks that Russia eventually won in 21 years. And Putin specifically said, this was very important, he said Russia did not take anything that was not theirs to begin with. This is the mindset that is important to understand. It's very different from the West. And again, the short answer to your question is certainly there might be some within the military, especially those in the lower ranks who are shocked at the disparity between what the Russian government told them and what they actually saw on the ground. There's been no shortage of apologies or from lower ranking Russian officers. You saw, for example, conscripts who were being lied to and told they were going into a training operation and so forth, right? But when it comes to the leadership driving this, no, I don't think fundamentally this has changed at all. And they have a lot more to bring to bear.
That's rather disconcerting. Anna Borshevskaya is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of the recent book, Putin's War in Syria, Russian Foreign Policy and the Price of America's Absence. Anna Borshevskaya, thank you so much for your time and critical insights.
Thanks very much for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.